The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
So this is just a bit of a favour that we're asking. We're taking part in a podcast survey and would really appreciate your help. It's a short, anonymous survey. It'll only take 5 minutes, maybe six, maybe four, who knows, to complete. Just go to podcast.study to start the survey and please show your support for us by compiling this survey. I thank you. Hello and welcome to News Roast. My name is Jolyon Rubinstein.
My name is Hayden Prowse.
And this is Three Courses of Conversation.
This is News Roast. Jolyon and I get together and we invite a guest on each week who brings us three courses of conversation. It's a metaphor.
It a metaphor for?
Well, it's, you know, the whole idea of getting your teeth stuck into something, masticating it for a bit, digesting it and then shitting it out.
Yeah. I mean, what we've got here is we have got real deal golden nuggets that we are mining for you. We are literally trying to attack that vein. I mean, this is the gold rush of information, isn't it? This is the nuggets that you can bring to a family dinner. Or for instance, if you've just got someone pregnant and you've got to meet their family for the first time, you've never met them before, mind. And this is what would happen. So, you got my daughter pregnant?
Yes, I did.
Did you listen to that Bruce Barry on News Roast?
Yes, well, we're very happily engaged and I plan to take care of the baby. And did you know that certain tribes in deepest Amazon have horizontal social structures?
David, it's no problem, he's banged up my daughter! And that is the sort of incredible opportunity we are giving you to take fuck-ups in your life and turn them into golden moments simply by giving you nuggets of anthropological gold, sociological gold.
Yes.
Basically all the illogicals.
Yes.
Philosophical, anthropological.
Absolutely. And without further ado, I'd just like to tell you, the audience, that this week we have a very, very special guest.
Oh.
You may have seen it, depending on you know, whether you watched TV throughout the mid to late noughties, some of the best TV I think I've ever seen.
Ever.
The most engaging TV. Bruce Parry.
Super traveller, explorer.
Anthropologist. Would you describe yourself as an anthropologist? Perhaps not by education.
Definitely not trained. Yeah, sort of a pet.
A pet anthropologist. Bruce Parry is someone that I've sort of followed for years and years and years through his work on TV, through sort of seminal documentary series such as Tribe, which saw him go into the deepest jungles and pretty much every continent on Earth and meet some of the most incredible people. And what was always, I mean, there's so much more to your story, which we're going to talk about. But for me, that was how I got to know you. And it was, you were the perfect kind of vehicle for that series because you went to these cultures which were so alien to our culture. And you had this ability to immediately engage with everyone that you met. And they all, one of the best things of the series was how much they all liked you.
Yeah.
You'd rock up in deepest Amazon and these people that were, you know, essentially living in a hunter-gatherer society, like immediately connected with you and you were all of their best friends all of the time. And a lot of that, I think, was to do with the fact that you did not give a shit. You would do anything they asked you to do, whether it was taking some hallucinogenic drug or putting a bone through your bloody nose or putting a leech in your... You would just do it. And I think they respected you for that, didn't they?
They did, actually, yeah. I mean, like, I think anyone going there, they would like initially. And they are just wonderful people, always. They were just such glorious people to be with. But it did help that you muck in, of course. If you sit in your caravan on the exterior and just go in for a day's viewing, a day's filming, there's a them and us. But if you literally dive in there, eat their food, drink their drink, to do their rituals, then of course they another door opens.
I mean, I would expect nothing less than the legend that is Bruce Parry to be this humble.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm unsurprised completely. I don't think, Hayde, we've given this enough of a big up. You know, this man, documentary maker, author, indigenous rights activist, explorer, trek leader, and blooming former Royal Marine.
Yeah, can we start with that? So you started your, I guess, early life career in the army. You were a Marine. Can you talk about that for a bit?
Well, I came from a military family, and I left school not wanting to go to university, but kind of wanting to prove myself to myself. And I looked around thinking, what was the toughest thing that I could do to like prove myself, especially physically? And sort of becoming an officer in the Marines felt like impossible, so I thought I'd give it a go. And then you just get caught up in the whole thing, and before you know it, you're spat out of the sausage factory and you are one of the sausages.
So you've kind of always had that like deep seated need to go to really inhospitable, difficult places.
Yeah, I did have a... It wasn't so much about the sort of inhospitable and stuff. It was more about a physical prowess I wanted to prove myself.
I read that you, at the age of 23, became the youngest officer ever to be made head of fitness and training for the Royal Commandos. Marine Commandos. I'm just thinking, not only were you one, you were like, right, you maggots.
The fittest one.
Listen, you guys, you're nothing. Yeah. So how did that... I mean, how's... You know...
I was fit at that age. I think it was a mistake for me to get that job that young.
Were you just crazily ripped?
I was quite...
Your body fat index.
I was in a good zone. There's no photos of me, but like, I was in a good zone back then. Yeah, I was just... That was all it was about. We were all so focused. We were all so... We used to call it core pissed. We were just drunk on being Marines and loving it.
Went to Loughborough Uni after that, right? And
yeah,
you decided to go.
Well, because I was
studying.
Head of physical training for the commando training centre.
So what was the thinking there? Were you like, I've reached this level of excellence. I need a new challenge. It sounds like you're.
No, I think I was getting booted out anyway.
Oh, really?
I think I was on my way out. I was
from the
a
army?
Consummate drunk.
Right.
And like, I'm pretty rubbish. You know, I was a little tearaway. I was in a lot of trouble all the time.
Really?
Yeah. I was a bad un. And so I was probably on my way out anyway. And
you're
I
one
just
of Donald Trump's bad dudes.
One of Donald Trump's bad dudes. And you know, and it's quite hard leaving because you do have a meal ticket for life, and there's such bravado, and there's such sort of everyone's looking inwards. It's only, you know, the rest of the world just doesn't matter when you're in that space. And so leaving is difficult. But for me, the reason I went to Loughborough was because I had this physical training qualification. I felt like if I go to uni, because I hadn't done before,
right,
then that can give me a few years to figure out who I am and what I'm going to be in this like, weird civilian life that is going on outside. And so I went, and I only lasted a year. I got bored. I mean, having come from being physical training instructor in the Marines to go to Loughborough was just like,
And how did you...
Didn't really happen in the same way.
Get from that into doing tribe and TV stuff?
Well, basically, I then started almost straight away, the day I left the Marines, I went on an expedition. And a friend of mine at school, his dad, who was a dear, wonderful inspiration in my life, he used to lead these expeditions out in Asia. So because I had that link, I went out on one of these trips.
Was this your first one?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah,
so where was that to?
That was to Sulawesi.
Is that in Indonesia?
Yeah. And so, and it was just this sort of charitable thing doing science and conservation work in that part of the world. And then so all the time I was at Loughborough for that first year, I was like helping out with this organization doing these things. And then basically there was a job came up and I just took it and left the university and I got into this. No, this is long before TV.
Sorry, doing the
so
tracking.
This was
yeah,
doing these
I
sort
see.
Of like,
yeah,
so I was working with tigers and orangutans and rhinos and you know, turtles out in these Sulawesi, Seram, Ambon, New Guinea, Java, all of these islands. So that was my early, that was kind of the first thing I really did.
So were you daunted by that? Was there a sense
of... No, because
concern,
the Marines gives
you
this absolute self-belief. I mean,
really?
Like to a really quite detrimental degree when you realize that you're not as great as all that, but you come out thinking that you are God's gift to everything.
Is it
and
kind
everyone.
Of an invincibility?
Absolutely.
Context.
Which right. they get as an officer, especially they give you that and it's an amazing gift in a way, but it is also a curse because it's not real. Mm. It's something that's been drilled into you that you are the so that you can lead a group of guys, you know, over the trenches and into the thing.
Does it matter that it's not real? I mean,
I think that in sort of polite society, having these people running around ex-forces, as I was, it's like, you civvies are a bunch of useless twats, and I can do anything out the way. Yeah. And then you realise that there's this thing called creativity that, that we don't have, so we're not so down on. Mm. But we were, you know, we are good communicators and we were good organisers, but there's a lot of other skill sets that we didn't have at all. And it took a while for us to figure that out.
So you went from kind of leading treks to kind of being the face of, I imagine, a big sort of television production that would...
Well, it was a slow journey in a sense that those early trips, I wasn't really engaging so much with the indigenous people. I was going to places where they were around, but mostly it was about science and conservation. Yeah. So it would be more with wildlife. Mm. But there was often indigenous peoples in the areas. Mm. But that just gave me an understanding of how to exist in the jungles and stuff and how to, you know, because I'd learned a lot about how to lead and how to be good running around in the military. But then suddenly this was like a civilian version where you're off doing stuff. And my leadership skills, I guess, came in useful, which is why I did them.
So how did you end up? So
the TV stuff came much later. Well, I quit those expeditions and then got into the film industry. Because most of my friends had all joined the city and stuff.
You went
and I didn't want to do that.
As a runner into TV, didn't you?
So into film.
Unbelievable.
Jolly was just saying how weird that must have been.
It was.
Going from being an officer in the army to...
Yeah, and having then led 15
sorry,
expeditions.
Making a researcher a tea.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can you just... There's a meeting with the commission. Can you just bring around... He likes biscuits. Yeah. Don't put sugar in.
And Bruce Parry's thinking in his head, I could kill you with one finger.
Poor Bruce Parry. I mean, listen. Any TV commissioners listening, Bruce Parry could have you, mate. Yeah, all right, and I want you to know that now. And
it's probably how he got his first series.
Absolutely. Is that how you got? Did you offer a couple of TV commissioners together?
I just laced the TV until it came my way. No, I did. I did film.
Psychotropics could probably help a couple of TV commissioners. To be honest, a bit of creativity.
But you know, I was totally dead set against all that stuff. You know, I was so. If I'd seen someone smoke a spliff, I think I'd have called the police in those early days.
Wow,
really?
I was so
quite straight.
I was very straight. Yeah. Came from that sort of a background.
What a different world to explore.
Yeah.
Probably the most dangerous environment you've ever been in, being in TV production company.
Well, it was actually more film and pop videos and commercials back then. So that's what I did initially. And then I quit. So I did about 4 or 5 years of that. And then I realized that I didn't want to be in that industry either. And then I went off to basically, Millennium was coming up. And I thought, I want to go and climb this mountain that I'd seen when I used to do these trips all those years ago.
This is the second biggest mountain in Asia, which not many people talk about.
Yeah. And I'd seen it on a map and I hadn't heard anyone else who'd climbed it. And I thought, well, Millennium's coming. I love New Year, but this is going to be an anticlimax. Why don't I go somewhere they don't even know what Millennium is?
Yeah. Wow.
Why don't I go and do this trip that I've always wanted to do? This is the moment. So I went and my friend who'd been working in the film industry with me said, look, why don't you take a camera? You'd do a really good job. And because I'd been in the film industry, I'd never been in front of the camera, but I was like, okay, I can use a camera. Let's do that. So I took a camera. We got some sponsorship by a TV company. And off we went. And that basically started it all off.
So you were documenting. Wow. You started essentially creating a video document of just the actual realities of the journey.
It was a pure lad's ego-driven, let's go climb a mountain in the middle of nowhere where there's no one's ever been, where we can find people that no one's ever seen. You know, it was like that sort of kind of almost colonial lads, let's go and prove ourselves. I was still in that frame of mind, you know. It was as long before this other side of me came out.
And so you essentially kind of just did a DIY, this is what me and Julian did actually, did a DIY TV job and then TV commissioners, I guess,
basically.
Sort of I was tingling when he was just saying that, you know, lads, going exploring places that you've never been, culture you've never seen, you know, up a mountain no one's ever heard of. I'm like, oh, take me with you. I can totally see why people became so sort of, because it's captivating.
Yeah.
We were very lucky, I think, in that it was exactly the moment when the first cameras that you could take away, and we had solar panels were finally small enough and all the rest of it. So we could stick everything in a rucksack.
Holy
the first
shit, mate.
Time.
So you were charging your batteries off the back of solar panels.
Yeah. So we were carrying big rucksacks and we had people carrying food for us, but we carried all our stuff ourselves. And that was up until that time, almost impossible. And so we were sort of, in many ways, I do put a lot of our success, or my success in a way, to the luck of that moment. You know, nowadays anyone can go out, but you're sat, the market's saturated.
Right, yeah.
But
yeah,
back then,
you did it first.
We were like kind of at the cutting edge. And so we went and did a wonderful expedition. It was amazing, but it's no more than many other expeditions going on around the world.
First of all, do you like a three-course meal? Is that kind of your kind of jam?
I absolutely love it. Yeah,
what's your sort
one.
Of favourite starter? Like if you were going to
cook, an actual you, one, not a metaphor.
I'm not, no, no, I'm terrible, sir.
No way, Bruce no. Parry. You've been all over. You're not a good cook.
No, I'm not.
I am stunned.
Yeah, I'm happy to offer that.
Well, what's your favourite starter that you've had, given that you've probably sampled cuisine from all over the world?
Mushrooms.
Oh, mushrooms. Sauteed? Just garlic?
Sauteed. Garlic sauteed. Yeah.
Nice.
So what have you bought for us for your metaphorical starter?
I was thinking that perhaps equality, egalitarianism, something that's come to me recently that has become a big part of what I'm thinking about and trying to figure out in the world today.
For anyone who doesn't understand, why don't you explain like what that means to you?
Well, I mean, we all know about equality. Yeah. So that's sort of same. It's respecting everything equally.
Yeah.
Not necessarily seeing everything as the same. That's sameness. It's just, for me, equality is about sort of respecting everything equally.
And in what way, you know, you came from a sort of very hierarchical early career.
Yeah.
And in what way did spending all your time with these incredibly sort of, well, these tribes, how did that affect your perception and understanding of equality?
Well, you know, it wouldn't have been a thing that I would ever have talked about right up until the very last tribe that I ever lived with.
Right.
So of those 15 episodes I made, every single one of those groups, I would say, was just a microcosm of the society that we have here.
Right.
Everything was being played out
in
its own interesting and slightly different way, but in
sort of
really,
hierarchical.
Pretty much. Or even if it wasn't patriarchal, it could be matriarchal. But they were all hierarchical. And so many of the other facets of those societies were very similar to what we have here. I mean, there'd be different colours and shades, but it was very similar. And so it didn't even cross my mind as a thought until I came to the last group. And they were like a pre-agricultural society. They were called the Penan in Borneo. And I wasn't even interested in going there at first because I'd been to Borneo many times and I was like, I couldn't believe that there was this group in this little bit of forest left in Malaysia. And I knew Malaysia has already destroyed all its forests. So it took a lot of persuasion for people for me to go there. And then from the first moment I was there, I was struck there was something totally different about them. And I actually couldn't figure it out. It was it was just their way. It was their way. And like I knew that they said there was no leaders, there was no shamans, it was like that sort of stuff. But that was just a concept. But it was something actually about how they behaved and how they were. It was just something in the ether in their space.
Try and give an example. How would it differ sort of a very basic human interaction in a hierarchical society to in a society that you witnessed like that?
I don't know that I can. The story, I guess, that I'm expressing is that I couldn't figure it out. I just felt something about them that felt so peaceful and so calm. And I was just so caught up in like trying not to be too romantic, trying not to be too utopian. It's like, but there was something. And it's only actually when I left that I read much more about it, that the penny started dropping, that there was something incredibly special about them, which is why I actually chose to go back. And that's the film that I've just made, is going back to try and explore what that was.
So this is this feature doc, which I think Hayden was lucky enough
Wei.
To see.
So I went to the, am I pronouncing that right?
Tawai.
Tawai, sorry. So Tawai, which is an incredible film that Bruce Parry has self-financed and self-produced.
So excited
for the last
to see this.
3 years, 2 years?
Six
years. How are people going to see this, Bruce? How are they going to
It's going to be out in the autumn. It's going to be out
it's
in the autumn.
It's going to be a cinema release, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you need to see it on cinema, Bruce was saying before the film, because it's kind of an experience as much as it is a sort of, it's an essay documentary. It's his opinion and the ideas and the perceptions that you've taken from the last sort of over a decade of living and spending time with these tribes. But the tribe that you talk about,
the Penan people,
Penang people, just explain, they have this concept called Tawai, which is...
Tawai.
Explain what that is, because that's kind of fundamental to what you're talking
about.
It is,
yeah. I mean, like, for them, Tawai is just a word that they use. We find it hard to describe or to translate, like many words we find hard to translate. But this one in particular, because it's a feeling they have of connection to landscape.
Right.
Mm. And I thought that was a nice sort of metaphor for what we were looking at. Yeah. It was about connection. It was about a feeling that they were having.
When you say landscape, do you mean living things?
Yeah.
Trees,
well,
forests.
But also, forest. Also, well, yes, all things living, but they would also say, well, also rivers and rocks. And
stuff. With each other
so
as well.
All does of that being a living.
Include their society, that concept.
Yeah, I mean, like, I think that they you know what? I don't know how to answer what really Tawai is. I think that's something that I've tried to get my head around, and all I know is it's something that they've got and I kind of don't
have. But there's definitely, you feel in the film, there's this connection between you and them. It's really, they're quite tactile with you. There's a lot of, like, immediately you go back and there's all this love. They've met you, what, 10 years previously?
Yeah, something like that.
Haven't seen you for a decade, and you go back and you talk to them and there's this immediate connection with them. You can kind of see it through the screen. Yeah. I can kind of feel what you're trying to describe is
what was really interesting about them, which is I guess where we're going to with this sort of egalitarianism, is that their whole sense of identity and the way that they perceive the world around them, the way that they perceive themselves in relation to the world around them, I think this is why it was so intangible to me at first. I think it's a very different way of perceiving the world around them to how I do.
Yeah.
They see the way they see themselves in relation to everything is as a part of it.
Yeah.
They see themselves much less as separate entities, which is how I'm generally seeing myself.
Egoic, me.
Very much. And I think that they're on a daily basis, they don't separate things out in the way that I separate
things out. They don't have
them in
boxes in the way that we've delineated it.
Yeah.
And what you do in the film, Bruce, is you try to sort of take what you've learned from living in that society and apply it to, you know, modern westernized culture and how we're living and the problems we're facing. Maybe talk about that for a second, because, you know, you talk about the huge impending environmental disaster that we're all on the brink of. You talk about, you know, the fracturization and the sort of hierarchy in modern society. Like, what can we learn from groups like the Penang?
Well, I mean, it's hard to get your head around because the Penang is so far away from where we're at. And you're like, okay, Bruce, well, that's a lovely idea of where it might have been once upon a time. But, like, really, is that possible? Mm. So we kind of try and look at a number of different layers. And one of them is how they've structured their society. But I think alongside that, the thing that I think is often forgotten, because you can, like, go along a very dry and cold analysis and say, oh, well, they're sharing culture and they share because they're nomadic and it's very logical for them to share. And you can have all this very dry understanding of how it is that they operate in that way, along, you know, in their very immediate return society with the sort of resources around them. But there is also, I believe, there's this other element that isn't so often talked about. And we sort of try and explore that a little bit. And that's like how they're actually perceiving themselves, how they're actually literally physically experiencing the world around them and their relationships. And so we enter into that space a little bit in the film. And my sort of understanding of why it was so difficult, but what really came across me in the end is that they genuinely, I think if I took any one of these people and put them to one side and asked the question, they'd all come up with a very similar answer, and not in a negative way. They care for the future generations. They're not caring so much about their own personal needs. They're only, all of their, I mean, it's not because of some altruistic aspect. They're genuine. The way they live is because they care for the future generations. And they care for each other.
I take it that the profit motive is not a part of their society.
Not so much. No, they go out and catch animals and pick fruit, and that's their sort of day to day.
Without sounding like a massive pinko, which I'm actually not. I mean, I'm definitely a capitalist, but I sort of feel like there's the justification of the profit motive is sort of like, if you think about it, you have to make something now. You've got to do it now. You've got to process stuff now. When you've come into contact with so many different societies, what do you think underpins, what are the sort of roots that you've seen, sure, in the West, but in all these different tribes that you were saying were hierarchical, that changes that perspective to think about more about now and me rather than we in the future?
And can I just add something to that? Because I'd also like to ask, if you don't think that modern Western society is actually in part a sharing culture. There's loads of amazing examples of altruism and sharing within our culture as well. I don't know if it's necessarily true that you're kind of assuming that that doesn't exist.
No, I'm not assuming that it doesn't exist. And I'm not saying that we don't do things for other people. We do. But what I'm talking about is, look, I'm a child of the 80s. Right? Mm. I was born in 1981. My first memories, a lot of my really strong memories are adverts.
Mm.
And they are, as I've got older and I've started to understand more what advertising is and what it was for, not just selling cigarettes to kids, but it's programming. It's mental programming. And what I'm really interested in about what Bruce is talking about is, what he's talking about is this perceptual difference in how the entire world is experienced just through their mental sort of eyes. Now, what the studies that I have, you know, in the last couple of years come across seem to suggest that we're pretty much a fully formed person by the age of 5. After that, it's just biology. So in a way, this kind of early inputting into your mind from whatever stimulus you're getting is kind of programming how you're going to see the world. In the same way that, you know, if I have a Apple Mac and it's just a raw computer, I can put different programs on it that do radically different things. Where the hard material human is still, you know, the same, but you can sort of program it to have radically different perceptual ideas of what's around you. I'm interested in getting back to sort of this idea about what you saw underpinning that stuff. You know, was it about profit, or was it, you know, what makes you more me rather than we, and what makes you more, oh, things now rather than all look after things for the future?
Well, using the Penan again as the most interesting example, because like I said, most of the other groups were already on the path to hierarchical societies like we are, and so all sorts of different influences. I mean, clearly, I don't want to be disparaging about all these amazing other groups that I've been with, and I hope that is not how it comes across. It's like I just had a particular interest in the Penan. And I think that one of the things we explore in the film a little bit is... that this notion of lack of separation is just inherent in the whole of the way that they are anyway. So there's no walls in their houses. Mm. They all see each other.
There's no walls in their houses?
Well, no, they just have little stilted things that they just put up. Mm. And they're, so like yours will be there and mine will be here. Yeah. And so the sorts of ideas like we have in our family units, where if I'm having a bad day, my kids are going to know that I'm having a bad day, or they're going to deal with my bad day. Yeah. Whereas in a place where the children are so much more fluid within the community, my bad day isn't just passed directly on. And so actually,
everyone's.
It's all being shared. And so the wider space of all of this emotional turmoil that we have to deal with in our family units is actually disseminated out. And over time, because also I think that they have tools for healing, for releasing a lot of the stresses and traumas that we have to deal with in our very sort of clockwork lives that we have, their lives are much more related to the sort of the rhythms of nature. And you don't get stressed with the rhythms of nature. It's so much bigger than you just don't get stressed about it. Mm. You know, we get stressed because it's like, I've got to be there on time and the bus is late. And we have our stress levels are like astronomical, and theirs are just not. And so everything about that way of being is much more tranquilo. And even when there are stresses, they're disseminated out, and they have tools on top of that to, like things like the ayahuascas or whatever, to allow those things
what
to
be. What other tools do they have?
Well, that particular group just doesn't seem to need them, because they've had forever just being with the rhythms of nature. It's only, you only find things like the iboga and the ayahuasca and the singing and the dancing and stuff when you start coming into the more agricultural societies. And these are tools to get back to how that was that we always were. That's my take on it.
But Bruce, you mentioned family, and you kind of mentioned this before as well, but can we extrapolate from a tiny group like that, which is essentially a large family, probably, you know, most of them are related to each other, they're all cousins, or, you know, how many people in each group?
That band, they call them, was like, I don't know, it was 30 people.
30, so tiny. Like, can we really extrapolate from that to modern society? Is there any way, because isn't it true that, you know, up until very recently, actually, the biggest cause of death in the world for humans was violence by other humans? And that's kind of changed relatively recently. It's now suicide in a lot of cultures,
sure.
Violence on yourself. But how can you, you know, would the Penang, for instance, have been so peaceful and kind of connected to another sort of rival group that might have threatened their food source?
This is absolutely the question that I would always have myself. It's like, okay, Bruce, it's all very well you coming back with these lovely little sort of examples of these wonderful groups that are all looking after each other. And it's well known that, like, ostracization is the biggest threat there, you know. Yeah. You can't live outside the group, so you don't play a game, you're out. And so that's the thing that keeps them gelled.
Yeah.
And this is I mean, I'm not a trained anthropologist, but even I know that is the obvious argument against any of these sort of utopian dreams of how groups can be. Until I met this anthropologist called Jerome Lewis and his wife Ingrid,
who's in your film as well.
Who's also in the film. And then he took me out to an indigenous group that he lives with, who are very like the Penan in that they are prior to agriculture, they're prior to settlement. These are nomadic hunter-gatherers. Mm. And they're in the Congo, and I spent time with him. And he is a specialist in exactly these types of pre-agricultural societies, nomadic hunter-gatherer societies. And he then blew my mind with what he had to say. So, for example, we go out, and this group isn't in our film, but it's in the sequel that I'm going to be putting out. And this is where you now start answering these questions.
What does he say? What's
his... So he's like, so I go and live with this group who are in the Congo. And again, it's this like group of maybe 30, 40 people. And I pose the same question. It's like, you know, how am I going to relate this to anything beyond just this area? Because it's like so unique and it's so... And he goes... and I said, surely they're going to have their own rivalries with their neighbouring groups and all the rest of it. He goes, no, what are you talking about? No. This is a fluid group. This isn't a group that sticks together the whole time. Wow. This is a fluid group that people are moving backwards and forwards that stretches into tens of thousands of equal peoples throughout this forest. And it was always like this. Wow. And this is our ancestral heritage. And don't let anyone tell you that prior to this, it was all about aggression. He goes, yes, there are lots of people who want to project our own shit into the past, and they will find those skulls that have the holes in them. They will find this and they'll find that. But I'm telling you now, that is not the case. And like, wow.
I've been lucky enough to do is, as well as meet, you know, people like you. I've also met a lot of people who are sort of technological utopianists and stuff. And they talk about network versus hierarchy. And I had a fascinating conversation.
That's interesting. It's coming back in a way, isn't it?
This is the whole point, is that this guy who is a software engineer was, I imagine these people as being kind of like bespectacled, kind of slightly kind of chino-wearing Uber geeks. Maybe they're a bit Silicon Valley and have got a hoodie and drive a Porsche in, you know, in downtown San Fran. But this guy was like, just a really adventurer type guy. And I was like, why are you working with computers? And he goes, because the more I've studied old human behavior, the more I realize that we're learning again what we've forgotten, which is that this network of interdependent... So you understand at home.
Shall I...
The way that computers work is ones and zeros.
Yeah.
And what they are, they're binary machines, and you have a master unit that tells slaves what to do. That's how computers used to work. And then when the internet came along, it was the idea of 2.0. Like the more you had, the quantum sort of grew and grew and grew to get more and more and more effective. And that was about networks. So it was about saying, well, actually, all of you different people, you all have exactly the same amount of rights to edit and change whatever you want to change because you know how to do that best. And no one's going to tell you how to do it because it's how to do it best.
So there are plenty of examples of how network societies are being currently put into real life practice. You know, the free software movement, Richard Stallman. You know, plenty of, you know, Varoufakis is a CEO or a chairman, I think, of this gaming company.
This is Yanis Varoufakis, former Greek finance minister.
Greek finance
and
minister.
And fantastic motorbiker
and
pervader of motorbike fashion.
Very sexy man. A lot of girls swoon over old
Varoufakis. I'd go gay for him as well.
Yeah.
There's two. James O'Brien and Yanis Varoufakis.
Even though he is rather follically challenged, he's still incredibly sexy. Anyway, he is, I think, CEO or chairman of this gaming company, which is completely horizontal structure. You arrive in the company and you don't have a position. Everyone makes decisions collectively. And there are plenty of examples of this.
Wow.
You know Gore-Tex, the company Gore-Tex, run in the same way.
It's no.
It is Mozilla Firefox. I don't know if you know them.
Yeah.
They're an NGO.
Search engine.
Yeah, they're a not-for-profit. I think they might even be a charity, but they don't make profit
Shut
per
up.
Se. They are I think the second, or they used to be the second, I think they're the third or fourth most used search, sort of, not search engine, it's called
an
Internet Explorer, right now in the world. But they're run from collective contributions of voluntary time from hackers all around the world.
No.
That fix and solve the problems that the surf engine suffers and experiences.
The surf engine?
Yeah, you're surfing the internet with it.
It's I like it.
Right?
I just got
so if you're on Mozilla Firefox and there's a little bug in the system and you're a hacker, you contribute your time for free to fix the software that has a problem. Richard Stallman is a free software campaigner. There's a big free software movement in the world which says proprietary software is the work. It's not efficient. We could be so much more advanced and evolved if we were all allowed to contribute to the ways software is written and structured. And this goes beyond computers. It has ramifications for the rest
Everything,
of the world, because
yeah.
when Richard Stallman looks at Apple and their software, he gets so fucking angry and frustrated, because he's like, there are so many bugs in this system, and if you gave me the source code and you allowed me to fix it, me and my team of 50,000 hackers worldwide, we could solve it for you and make your system much better. But Apple is proprietary, so it won't allow them in. And his
idea,
it's
a closed network, isn't it? That was Steve Jobs' whole thing.
Exactly.
Closed
in order to make more profit.
Yeah,
and his idea of a future utopia is a utopia in which everybody kind of comes together collectively to make things better, essentially. And there are examples in business where this is working, like Mozilla Firefox and all these companies. It's interesting.
That makes so much sense. And you know, clearly there are obstacles, because it goes against the grain of our, you know, how we grew up thinking like more is better and we have to like feather our own nest and all the rest of it. But those things, I think, will win out in time. I mean, given an equal playing field. I mean, obviously those who own the IP addresses and nation states and stuff might like start, you know, messing with that a little bit. But given equal opportunity, that sort of, once you buy into that and once you get it, you know it works for you better.
I mean,
and it makes you feel better.
You say, you know, they might do that. I mean, there is and has always been active suppression of this kind of idea.
Yeah.
You know, the most recent example is Occupy Wall Street, you know, which obviously started in New York, spread to a number of cities across the United States, spread here. We had the St. Paul's one here. But the writer Naomi Wolf, who writes for The Guardian, presented shocking evidence that over, you know, 40 different governors were convened and they all got rid of the settlement straight away, because they actually, their idea of a horizontal sort of society where people are just all equal, even the most embryonic form of that is terrifying, because the as you say, the people who have most to lose are nation states, really, because even corporations, because the thing about corporations are they just want to be as efficient as possible. And almost all corporations realize, especially now they're 24 hours a day, they're global, that it's impossible for one person to take care of everything, even, you know, just within one territory. So they've created networks so people can, you know, feed in and out. The one place that hasn't created networks is government. Because the PM doesn't want a networked PM. Theresa May's not going to be like, "Oh, right, mate, don't worry. You just get in here. Brexit does mean Brexit, but now you can know what it really means." She wants to be the only pervader of that knowledge. So are we looking at, I mean, you know, there's been other cultural utopian hopefuls who've said this before, but I mean, are we on the edge of something, Bruce? Do you think, I mean, you've travelled to so many different tribes, you come back into Western culture, and you go out again, you come back into Western culture. What are you seeing? Like, what's your perspective?
I'm sort of excited and terrified in equal measure. I think that I kind of welcome collapse, in a sense.
What is it, because of rebirth?
Yeah, I mean, I think there will be a lot of collateral damage, and it will be painful, but I think there is already collateral damage happening globally, and
Absolutely.
We're at the heart of that so often. And I think we're sitting on top of a pyramid, and we don't know how lucky we are, and actually a bit of a slap might do us good. And you know, for all of our sort of the direction that we're heading at the moment, which is all about gain, it's all about more, it's all about comfort and all. Actually, in my own experiences of life, when some of those things are removed, you know, when the lights go out in New York and people have to meet each other in the street, something else happens. And yes, so there's a lot of shit didn't happen that day that might have otherwise happened in a productive way, but in another way, other things happened. And of course, no one wishes ill on society or things to fall apart in a really destructive or negative way. But in actual fact, I wouldn't be sad if there was some financial collapse.
No, but I mean, listen, I'm telling you, if the apocalypse happens, you want to be around Bruce Parry, don't you? I mean, listen,
mate,
this man.
Bruce, when the apocalypse happens, come round my house. I'll cook you a dinner. You'll teach us how to survive.
Yeah.
You might have to come round my house, mate. Yeah.
No, but seriously, what would you need? Because you need, obviously, water. That's the thing you need first.
You need community. For me, the currency of the future is community. Because then we can get through everything.
Yeah.
You know, we can get through everything. Know your neighbours and connect with them and grow stuff in your garden.
Something that has blown my fucking mind in the last couple of years is meeting. And I've got to say, I just want to say at this point, I have huge respect for Oxford and Cambridge as universities. But what I didn't realise was how many people who went to these elite institutions live very, very isolated lives because of the scale of the academic endeavour often they're trying to do. Whereas I went to I'm at Sussex University.
We didn't do any work at all.
We didn't do that. We did spend a lot of time sitting around drinking tea.
Fostering community. That was what that
fostering
was.
Fostering community. But it's a genuine thing. And luckily that community has actually stayed together. We literally just before this, we met up with a good friend of ours who we haven't seen for about 3 or 4 years. He's doing fantastically well. But again, it's that idea of community. But Thatcher said there's no such thing as community, didn't she? Mm. There's been an active destruction of the we in society. Why is that, do you think? What have you seen?
I think it's just one of these wonderful paradoxes of life is that we often, what it is that we strive for isn't what's best for us in the long run. And we're all striving for our freedom and our free time and our space and our privacy. And then it's like we're all kids in a sweet shop gorging ourselves and realizing after all that it's not actually that good for us. So we love our privacy and we love all of these big houses. And then you sit in your big house and you're like, I'm really fucking lonely.
Yeah.
And so we're just going in the wrong direction, I think. And often when those pillars are pulled apart and you have to engage with your neighbor and so he gives you a bit of a hard time because you're a bit of a twat. But after a while, you realize you are a twat and actually then you become friends and then something else happens.
And something about learning.
And we're all living in our little prisms and our little sort of glass boxes being very precious. So putting off best pictures up on social networks and not actually dealing with our stuff at all. But when we do have to physically engage with each other and look at our stuff, then we start having a laugh again.
Yeah.
And I think we're just going in the wrong way, and I'd be all up for it all.
So this leads us quite nicely onto our main course, which you'll introduce in a moment. But first of all, Bruce Parry, what do you generally like to eat for a main course on a Sunday afternoon?
Yes,
Bruce?
Sunday afternoon. I went vegetarian a few years ago, and
I
you didn't have to kill your dinner like Bruce Parry's had to do loads of times. Probably had to catch pigs, snakes.
I've caught a number of beetroots in my life and murdered them.
In Whole Foods.
Yeah. But I've come back of late. I've come back. I now eat wild food, wild meat.
The only meat you eat is wild.
Well, I don't have it. I don't label myself in any way. Mm. So I'm a little bit more flexible than that. But I try to. Yeah. It's more about the industry and where it's come from.
Yeah.
And having just made this film where I realized how sentient plants and trees and rocks and everything, it's like I find it harder to differentiate just between animals and plants. So it's like, so in the end, and also just my vegetarian lifestyle, I also noticed was perhaps causing all sorts of problems with the quinoa growers in the Andes. And so I was like, so I've come back to just being a little bit more conscientious about anything and where it's coming from. And so right now, let's say,
KFC.
Just for the sake of it, KFC.
Imagine if fucking Bruce Parry turned up and he's like, the new colonel, Bruce.
Well, Bruce Parry, the face of KFC.
Don't
do it.
When you're deep in the jungle and there's nothing to eat but worms, all you really think about is KFC.
What is the maddest thing, the sort of most bizarre thing that you've had to eat or catch and kill and then eat
And I kind of did make my fortune from eating crazy shit. So there's been a few... lots of big fat grubs and beetles and live things as well, where you have to put it in your mouth and it wriggles around. But there was one time I was in, and I'm not proud of this, but I have to answer the question honestly. There was a time I was in with the Adi people in the Himalayas in northern India, and They have a rat festival every year, and they made this thing. They called it, well, we called it a rat cake, but they didn't hit the meat of the rat. It was just the intestines and the tail and the claws.
Oh my God!
All mixed up.
What?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like
rat all, claws,
tail, Jesus. And intestines, and then the meat was put somewhere else, and then this was then sort of like mixed up in a gooey dough.
What?
Not even cooked, boiled. So you've got this gooey, doughy thing.
Rat claw tail.
Yeah, yeah, like, it was pretty bad. And I remember, I try and be culturally sensitive, but none of them spoke English. And holy, I remember shit, the camera, man, looking at me and then going, come on then, what's this like? And I remember, I feel terrible about this, but they said, well, what's it like? And I ate a bit, and it's like, it's not that bad. But I said, but the smell is so pungent. And I described it, and I'm horrified at how bad I am as a guest. But I described it as a mixture of, it's, I was like, I took a sniff, it's like, it smells like a mixture of death and toilets. Oh. Which, of course, everyone was incredibly happy with this answer. Great presenting, Bruce, well done. That's but then I was just like, later on, it's like, well, one day those people are going to speak English and watch this show, and this is their delicacy from their festival. I was like, how rude.
Mate,
how
I really
rude.
Wouldn't fucking worry about it, Bruce Parry. You're giving yourself too much credit here. If I was forced to eat rat claws with fucking rat tail in a doughy thing, mate, I'm shitting hell. I'd just be out of there. Has there anything that you've just gone, I'm sorry, mate, I can't eat that.
No, there's only one time.
Only once?
No, there's only one time I didn't do something.
That's what,
in those
only
days.
Once?
What was that? What was that?
It's when they tried to force my penis back inside myself.
Oh my God!
What, for what purpose?
Okay, hang on a second. When we say, what purpose? And I'm sure that you got a massive baby's arm at the moment, because let's face it, you're the world's Bruce Parry. So we're talking that, what, someone tried to reinsert your penis into your body.
This guy who is this wonderful dude who I was living with when I was in New Guinea.
Sounds like a great guy.
And but he was very into me. He kind of came onto me in the treehouse on a few occasions.
I bet you've had a couple of little snuggles in the treehouse, haven't you?
Tried to cuddle up to me.
And I force your penis inside you.
Come into the treehouse. Let me sexually arouse you by putting your penis back into your own body.
And this guy who is kind of into me. Anyway, on the last day, we stuck a thorn through my nose. And
oh, so, my God, it's this guy! Like,
yeah, same guy.
Oh, my God.
And then there was this last thing that we were going to do, and they were kind of really keen. Anyway.
Now I will put myself inside you.
And the director...
This is a traditional ceremony. You must do this.
This is how we connect. I will put myself inside of you and then in your mouth.
Bruce, you don't have to do this. No.
No, it's culturally... I don't want to be culturally intensive. If he wants to put himself in my mouth, that's totally fine. No, Bruce, come on. What happened?
So go on, so...
Well, I remember once a person asking me, I was at a festival and everyone was telling jokes or stuff. And people were like, Bruce, why aren't you saying anything? I'm like, well, I haven't really got any stories. So, Bruce, you must have. And I'm like, okay, if I told you that one time this gay cannibal came onto me in a treehouse wearing a vegetable, what would you do? And everyone just cracked up. And that's all I had to say. And then we just went back to everyone else telling stories. But so that guy, he basically, so what they do is if you're running, because they're naked, either they wear a dried out, hollowed out vegetable on the tip of their penis and they tie it up and that keeps their dick out of the way, or they force it back in. Because when you're running through the forest, like, your balls kind of, they kind of have their own gravity and they but the dick is flying, it's flapping, so they just get rid of that. And one of the ways is to put it back in. But what, I didn't know how they did it. So anyway, so this guy with a big cheesy grin, who is the guy that's kind of madly in love with me, sitting in front of me, grabs my dick, and I don't have the wherewithal to push him away. And it takes two translations for me to go, please, can you tell him to be careful or no? So I don't get a chance to really stop it. And then he just grabs it. And if you imagine you roll over your foreskin, if you imagine you had a sausage roll and you squeezed it really hard, the meat would shoot out, wouldn't it? So like, he basically rolls over my foreskin to seal one end and then just grabs my dick and goes, and just fucking,
and it went into, and
just squeezes it as hard as he
can.
Painful? And then it just went straight back in. And
no!
Like, you're fucking kidding. And then so I'm like there, and like, I look back at the rushes. I go white as a sheet. All the blood leaves my face. I start pouring with sweat. My ears are ringing, and the director's next to me talking. I see his mouth move. I can't hear a fucking thing. I'm like, about to faint. And then so I lie down and stick my head, legs in the air, which is what you do when you're fainting, you know, like just to get the blood back to your head. And then there's like awful scene of me with half a dick and my naked with my legs in the air and like fucking flapping.
Just a quick legal klaxon here. No one on the News Roast podcast is in any way advising you to do this at home. In fact, I would say I would advise you absolutely not to try and put your dick inside yourself.
How long did it take for it to pop out?
It popped out relatively quickly.
Right, okay. Fucking hell. All right.
That was the only time I was like, no, because they were like, didn't work. I was like, it's with that one.
Do you know what? Now we've asked this, I've got to say, maybe we're going to put
any lasting problems?
we'll come to that minute. Listen, you've had some mad, mad fucking experiences, Bruce. But I want you to tell me the top four or five that just stick out, that you're just like, that was batshit crazy. How did that just happen? Just whatever comes straight to you.
Okay, I mean, well, that
put
one's...
your dick inside you. I think that's one.
What was the one where you had a leech in your ear?
I know, a maggot. It's like,
what was that?
You just want to talk about like...
Let's just do one more of these. What was that?
A few. I mean, that particular... It's the same group, actually. So they also stuck a bone to my nose and that shit hurt a lot.
Mate, I almost passed out watching that.
That was painful. And the thing is, we then had to take it out because we had to do a couple of shots from which we're going to go in earlier.
Yeah.
And so, but then I couldn't put it back in.
Oh, fucking TV.
And that was like,
I hate
well, you didn't get it on the first take, so you had to stick it.
No, Bruce, if you put that bone in, take it out, man. We've got to do some pickups from the shop before. I'm sorry that you're bleeding and horrendously wounded.
Well, it was the last day. No, I had it, and I had it in for a few days, and like, you know, you go to sleep, but then you absolutely, you just touch it, or you got a runny nose because it's constantly running. You forget you got this thing in, and then you just like basically touch, and it's a lightning bolt straight into the mind. Absolutely, that was hard. Jeez. But then about 3 or 4 days later, I then had to take it out because we went to this other tribe.
Septic?
It didn't go septic. We went through my septum.
Right, but you didn't go septic.
So a few days later, you got.
But then I had to take it out, and then I tried to put it back in again. And I just couldn't do it. It was absolute agony. But when I was with the guy. Because the crew were never with me in the treehouse. They were like, they'd camp outside. Mm. But in the night, before the fire dimmed, we would like communicate through sign language
just
and stuff.
Sort of sexy, gay cannibal.
Yeah, totally
like.
Gay
you're just on your own
like.
In the treehouse with a gay cannibal.
But I remember.
Did you have a help? Did you have a help sign? Like.
Did you have a safe word?
Get me out of the treehouse, mister.
I'm telling you, I'm a celebrity. It's getting a little bit old anyway, but I'm a celebrity. Get me out of the cannibal gay treehouse.
Will you spend an entire weekend on your own in a treehouse with a gay
Bruce,
cannibal?
You could present that. Anton Decker getting a bit old now. I reckon if you said, I'm a celebrity, get me out of the cannibal gay treehouse.
Yeah.
I mean, I can see the Benjamins just flying in.
So a few days later, you were taken to another tribe that did
this thing. Yeah, so we were, again, we went out to collect these witch tea grubs, which are like big larvae from a beetle, and they cultivate them specifically for these festivals and stuff. And so they chop down a sago tree, and they let it rot for a few days, and then they wrap it in leaves so that whatever's burrowed in doesn't come out. So then they leave that for a month. So the bugs get really big, but they stay inside. Mm. And then they come back and break it open. Then you have this feast of all these huge, I mean, properly big,
massive,
fat, like pus-filled, like things. They're pretty grim. But alongside that, we had read, or someone had said to us, that they use some of these maggot things for cleaning out their ear. So we asked them about that, of course. Anything like that, the directors were all like, "Come on, Bruce."
Yeah.
So
TV gold.
So I kind of inquired, and they were loving it. But they find these much smaller ones, and then they kind of pull out the tail a little bit so that it's dangling, and then they just lower that in.
Into your ear.
And then you can feel it crawling in, which isn't so bad, but it's the sound, because it's like. Eating your earwax.
Yes. Oh, it's disgusting. Hold on a second, Bruce. Do you think there's a possibility that these tribes, they saw a TV crew show up,
absolutely,
and then the researcher was like, "So what do your local customs do?" And they're like, "I don't know. We put grubs in our ears." Oh yeah, let's do that.
I think one day it'll all come out. It was all filmed in Shepparton.
Long before Bear Grylls was doing any of this stuff, You were doing it for real. Like,
oh, mate.
I never really believe it when Bear Grylls does it. But, like, you were fucking doing this shit 10 years before Bear Grylls was, you know, doing his sort of...
Are you tight with Bear?
He was very sweet to me. He was
I've met him.
But I don't know him now. No. But he was very sweet.
Who'd want to? I mean, you've done it before. Listen, Bear, you stay off the parry patch.
Bruce, let's move on to your metaphorical main, which kind of leads nicely on from what you're talking about before. What have you brought us?
Well, I use the word healing.
Right.
Yeah, and like, okay, it's a bit of a weird word, but like, I just thought that so many of the things that I had experienced in my own personal journey living with these peoples had actually had that effect on me. I didn't realize I needed it when I first started out, but the changes that have happened to me from the inside out, I can only describe as that. I was healed in a really profound and deep and beautiful way by my experiences. And often the experiences that people, when I engage with the public back home, for example, they're like, oh, you're that guy on TV. Oh, didn't you do that? Take that sort of weird hallucinogen. You know, poor you, that must have been horrendous. Like, God, I'm so sorry you had to go through that. And that's often the experience that I have when I relate to people back home. But the reality is that some of those things were the most positive and profoundly beneficial experiences of my entire life. And I don't know that really came across.
Well, you know, people like Graham Hancock, who's the sort of one of the foremost authorities on psychotropics and particularly ayahuasca, often talks about a lot of the qualitative research that was done in San Francisco in the 1970s, where users of heroin, of cocaine, people who are deeply depressed, use these psychotropics to increase their understanding of themselves. Are we talking now about the sort of experiences that you've had often with these kind of like unusual plants that have been used in shamanistic ways?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, in particular, I mean, there's lots of other ones that they do and that I've touched on a little bit. But in particular, yeah, I mean, like those which are so culturally misunderstood in our society. And I grew up, as I said earlier in our chat, in a world where I was so anti anything that wasn't sort of ordained by society.
As in booze and cigarettes. Yeah. Oh, what's okay. But you were saying before, you know, if I'd seen someone smoking a spliff, I probably would have called the police.
I mean, that's an extreme reflection on who I was. But I was very anti, verbally, aggressively against.
So what do you think, two things, what do you think needs healing in our society, and in what ways do you think these, you know, psychoactive substances or other things can heal people?
Well, I guess the best way to answer that is just to talk about myself, because I, you know, it's society is at large. Perhaps I'm just an example rather than
it's an unwieldy beast. I'll give it.
But I think that for myself. We talked earlier about the Iboga and the journey that I went on and reflecting on the sort of decisions that I'd made and all, and what have you. I think that I was definitely a person who was carrying a lot of masks. My life was a performance. I wasn't very authentic. I was like trying to be something else. I was also carrying, I feel like, a lot of, I can only describe as sort of electrical or energetic sort of felt like traumas that had happened to me from youth that were still contained within me. And when I have been through some of these purging processes with these plants, that I've literally felt what feels like some sort of knot of, I don't know, something that's caught up at a time that was from some trauma that has been able to be released. And then only when it's released are you able to reflect on, wow, that was a part of me that's happened ever since that time that I was attacked, or ever since that time that my father did something, or my mother, and that was whatever that was helping me, but it was helping me in that moment, but it's like it's got stuck and it's been affecting my behavior in a sort of overly protective or aggressive or whatever, depending on what it was. Those sorts of things have just been there, affecting my behavior my whole life, and some of these rituals I've just found that they've unlocked that and released it, and that's why there is often so much vomiting and purging, and for me these have happened so many times now because I've continued on that path a little bit, and it's just become so clear that that's in my own personal experience, that's exactly what it has been doing.
Well, you're not the only person to think that. It's important to say. And I think also I just want to be super clear here on the podcast that I don't think, you know, anyone sitting in this room would say anything other than these are incredibly powerful substances that need the deepest respect. They are illegal in this country, not in other countries.
But there's been medical research recently about the effects of psilocybin on people with terminal illnesses. So if you have a terminal form of cancer and you don't have long left, it's obviously an incredibly depressing thing. And one of the things that people don't often talk about in relation to terminal illness is the depression that accompanies it. And they gave a bunch of people with terminal cancers psilocybin, which are mushrooms, and it pulled most of them, I can't remember what the percentage was, out of their depression and made them sort of feel some kind of connectedness. And you talk about connectedness. It was connectedness that was the thing that they said had brought them out of the depression. And that was mushrooms.
It's interesting as well because Johan Hari, who's a slightly disgraced journalist in some ways, he did this incredible TED talk, which I'd recommend anyone watch,
great,
about
yeah.
addiction.
Mm.
And he believes that the opposite of addiction is not sobriety.
Yeah.
The opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And exactly getting back to what we were talking about with community and so forth. And another banned TED talk, which we have now spoken on the podcast about three times, which is Graham Hancock's War on Consciousness. And one of the
Why is that banned?
I think probably felt that they
talks
were talking
about
an illegal substance.
Drugs.
I guess. I mean, I've never, you know, met anyone from the TED organization. I'd love to know why. If anyone wants to tweet in and tell me why, it'd be great to understand. But what the main point here was that DMT, which is the active ingredient of ayahuasca, which I think people have heard about, which comes out of the jungles of the Amazon, and ayahuasca is in fact two plants mixed together, where the Brazilians, the shamans deep in the Amazon, had actually found the only other plant that actually was an enzyme inhibitor that enabled DMT to stay in your system for a lot longer. But what a lot of people don't realise is that DMT is actually a molecule that's present in every living thing.
Isn't it what's released when you die?
Yeah, and it's also referred to by a lot of people as the spirit molecule. There's a really interesting documentary on Netflix that's worth watching, The Spirit Molecule. Mm. And there is something that we seem to be missing, isn't there? In sort of I think a lot of people have written about the messages that are supposed to talk to you through these plants. What can these plants do? What are they offering us that we're not really getting?
I think there's many of them and they all work slightly differently, but in a very broad sense, I think that, you know, we go and take medicines for many things. Taking drugs or taking medicines we have in our society all the time.
Just had a cup of tea,
a bit of
caffeine.
And like where you know, drugs, the word drug and all these things are very broad. So, you know, sugar can be considered one, caffeine, as you said, all sorts of. And, you know, what is a medicine? What is a drug? And, like, we've just drawn particular lines and we see them in a very sort of. We in our society see the body as a very sort of mechanical thing, and we take drugs in a very material sense of, like, dealing with things in that sort of mechanical perspective. And I think that what some of these other medicines that other societies and other cultures have are ways of healing other parts of the mind, body, soul that isn't necessarily given so much credence in our society. So they are basically ways of healing the mind, actually, healing our connectedness, healing our connection not only to our own bodies, like me when I'm connecting to my body and releasing those aspects, but also connecting to community, connecting to nature, having an empathic experience beyond just seeing yourself as a separate being. For me they work in a number of different ways, but I guess to generalize, they work on my neurological system, and it's known that the dimethyltryptamine, for example, does exactly that. So it goes, I feel it going through my body and unlocking these things, these passageways, and I feel it doing that. And also, so it works on my body, and then also I notice that it does something where I do feel more connected. I feel
What's the effect that that's had in your life, in a sort of real practical sense?
In terms of your human relationships, I guess,
or anything in the real world. How does
it's brought me much closer to nature. It's made me realize that I am part of nature. I have brought plants and animals and the sun and the moon and the rhythms of nature much more into my daily life. I see things much less through a human centric perspective, and I see, and it's allowed me to place myself very much more in the wider sphere of being a part of the universe and not just this separate being. So that's and with that comes a sort of a humble respect of just being a small part of something much bigger. And that sort of humility has had a really beautiful influence in just stopping me charging around just doing what I want. You know, I'm part.
Do you think in relation to our own sort of current environmental disaster that is, you know, we're all on the brink of, that prescribing everyone mushrooms once a week would empathise us much more to what's happening in the world this and climate
is a,
change.
This, I can see the Daily Mail headline.
That's my lawyer. Yeah.
I mean, I think that is. I think genuinely, if people, you know, if our culture didn't involve, you know, alcohol, cigarettes, you know, even certain legal drugs that remain illegal are considered more socially acceptable than mushrooms. You know, people in this city, London, is sort of replete with cocaine everywhere you go. But if people were going out on a weekend and, you know, taking a few mushrooms,
so true,
we'd be so much more sensitive and emotionally engaged with each other and our society and our environment.
Clearly I'm going to be in the affirmative to some degree, but I think we all realise there's caveats that have to be placed.
I think you need to take the contrarian view. You know, people who have a predisposition, it's been proven time and time again, like actually my uncle who died, you know, who have a predisposition to psychological
psychosis. It can cause that.
It does trigger it. It's difficult. The only problem is it's difficult to know. Yeah. There's no test.
Unless you legalise it, you can never know.
You've asked me a very general question. Yeah. So, like, if I want to stay in the very general, which is the most dangerous place to be of all, like, I remember when I first did ayahuasca and the director and everyone was there, and I was interviewing they're also like sort of ayahuasca tourists at the time. This is on the BBC right. show. And I remember this guy in his interview saying, God, if the whole world did this, the world would be a better place. And I remember the director at the time going, how naive that was and how ridiculous that was as a statement. But it was exactly the feeling I also had. It's like, oh my God, if everyone could do this, the world would be a better place.
Was the director taking it?
No.
Interesting.
It was very clear to me that from the outside, that feels like a naive statement. But from when you've done it, you're like, oh my God, this has been, which is why people get so sort of evangelical about it. And yet, so I know that there's some people for whom, as you said, that it's dangerous to just sort of blankly prescribe it. But coming back to the broadest picture, like how we are with nature at the moment, we are causing all sorts of problems. Here is a medicine that allows us to reconnect and to heal and to bring ourselves back into relation with nature. There will be collateral damage if everyone took ayahuasca. Absolutely there would. And it's not for everyone, and there'll be lots of people popping and going all sorts of different directions. But as a whole, if I really want to answer that question,
our leaders, maybe Trump and Theresa May.
Put
it out there. I've spent so long thinking about that and thinking I could never really say it's for everyone. But actually, even though I know it will be really complex and there will be a lot of difficulties. In general, if I had to go, everyone have ayahuasca or no one have ayahuasca, I would go everyone have.
But this is interesting because you and I were on a panel with David Nutt, David Nutt, who was a government advisor, but then came out and said, I think that ecstasy was less dangerous than alcohol. Is that right?
Horse riding,
less dangerous than horse riding. And he got fired for saying that. Yeah. So there are huge taboos around these things.
Definitely. Well, I think the government said at the time was you didn't take into account cultural history and heritage and stuff. Yeah. It's like, which basically negated all of his scientific approach, and they were like, yeah, but we can't take on board of any of that because it's not the answer we wanted. And
that is so true.
You know, there's that wonderful Bruce Dickinson who did the Rat Park,
which
you mentioned earlier about the opposite of addiction being connection, and I think that resonates so much with my own personal experiences. And you know, for those who don't know the experiment, it's like they were trying to isolate some gene for addiction in these rats that were like those two pipettes in a small cage, one with water, one with cocaine. Mm-hmm. And the rats just kept going back to the cocaine until they were kind of like half dead. And they were like trying to isolate some gene, do some study or other. And this guy, Bruce Dickinson, was like, well, that just feels like, a slightly weird experiment in that these rats... Mm-hmm. Of course, they're taking cocaine, they're living in a little cage. So he created this huge what they called rat park, where they had many rats. They could all have sex. They had whatever food they wanted. There was wheels and water and all the rest of it. And then they put those same two pipettes in, one with cocaine and one with water. And they all tried the cocaine, but no one had it. They all just carried on with the water and lived their life because they were living a fully connected, enjoyable lifestyle. Yeah. And that when you take on board that as an idea and reflect that on our own addictive tendencies, I look at myself. I'm so addicted to many things. And like whether it's power, greed, sex, love, you know, all of these different things. My phone, you know, it's like...
It's true. I think if I had a lot of sawdust and a nice wheel to run by, I wouldn't take half as many drugs.
Beautiful. But, I genuinely live with some tribes with this thought in my mind. And like, so I was with this group called the Piraha recently in the Amazon. And they're interesting. They're at the center of quite a large sort of debate about language at the moment. And the whole thing about them is that they're very present. They don't have a future or past tense, allegedly, even to their language, and it's all very much about being in the present. So they're kind of interesting in that space. And so I was there with them, and them and others, but them in particular, they had the ability to just literally sit and just stare at the river going past for hours at a time in a way that previously I would have judged as like, I wouldn't want to be like that. That looks like the most boring life in the world and all the rest of it. But when but looking through a different prism, these people who are so, they're human beings and they have problems and they have aggression and negativity within their society like any others. But I would suggest much less. And they seemingly are very content beings in that they can just sit there and just allow things to go on.
I think that's fascinating. Does that connect to your dessert? Because I think your dessert kind of sums up your entire theory about the problem with our modern society and, you know, perhaps a solution or a medicine. You talk about your film as if it's a medicine.
Yes.
So what is it that you've brought us for dessert?
My dessert is about connection. So it just came to my head now, we're going to have a fondue. Dessert.
Okay. Would it be a chocolate kind of fondue?
Chocolate.
But he's terrible at this. What is your favourite dessert as well? We've only done this 7 times now.
My favourite, I do like a tiramisu. I used to go
Yes, he's in my side then. What do you think of creme brulee?
I don't mind it. Should I hate it?
What about bread and butter pudding?
Don't like that.
Yes, good. That's what I like to hear. He's a tiramisu man. Let him be.
I can do a profiterole.
So your metaphorical dessert,
yes,
Bruce Parry, is...
Is connection, living a connected life. You know, I guess this is the sum of what we've been chatting about. It's like the experience of being with some of these people who are not only connected to their own bodies and they feel like in balance, they're connected in their community and their families and then connected to the landscape. And it's just something that's given me so much cause for thought. It's like it feels like a really wholesome way of being and very at odds with where I'm at.
Do you feel, I mean, it's an incredible journey that you've been on from, you know, being in the military to now being quite a spiritual dude now. Your recent film is just pure sort of, it's about your journey, it's about your spiritual kind of awakening to a degree. You've come, it's quite a huge change for you as a person, isn't it? You've come through, it's been quite an amazing journey.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's this word spiritual is a weird one, isn't it? Because it's like a bit of a red flag. It puts people off. I don't want to someone like this, that's a spiritual film. Because people, you know, in our society, it's like people just, it's like, I don't want to go there.
Switch off.
You know, but what does it mean? What is spirit?
This is the core point.
This is it. Like, what is spirit? It's just is gravity spirit? It's like an invisible force. It's like, what is spirit? You know, what in the old days, like when you make your mash and you're going to make whiskey, that stuff, you got water vapor, but the stuff that disappears, that you don't see, it becomes vapor, is spirit. I mean, that's just all it is just a term for something that's invisible. Well, there are loads of invisible forces and we live such gross lives. When I say gross, I mean sort of in that sense that everything's
externalized. It's very externalized. Our idea of wealth is externalized. Idea of success, of beauty is externalized.
There's a huge explosion in
the West right now.
It's happening.
Yoga, meditation, people starting to respect that. You know, when you close your eyes and sit with yourself, which is near impossible for a lot of people when they first start doing it, because they have to actually face themselves rather than distracting themselves. The internal space is
more vast than anywhere you'll possibly go.
There's a lovely bit in your documentary, I forget the name of the doctor that you speak to.
Ian McGilchrist.
Sorry, Ian McGilchrist, was a pioneer in the idea of left and right hemisphere in the mind, in the brain. And you have this lovely moment where you're talking to him in the Highlands up in the Isle of Skye, and he talks about, you know, how... water has many different forms, whether it's ice, gas, or liquid. And, you know, this theory of consciousness perhaps having many different forms as well that it can take. And you assume that consciousness is this kind of static thing. Consciousness is what we have, is what humans are. But that could take many different forms that perhaps we haven't discovered yet, or perhaps we've forgot from... And it's interesting because, like Julian said, I am definitely a rationalist. I find it quite awkward. Julian loves to talk about spirituality, and I always like clench up. Like,
I don't love to talk about
Julian,
but the fact that he even calls it that shows you his
Julian, stop talking to me about how you feel spiritually. I can't take it. Anyway, I find it very awkward. However, having said that, I do feel that, you know, there are plenty, and I think it's unfair on science to say that science doesn't try to engage with these things. You know, there's a brilliant book called Gaia by James Lovelock, who was a NASA scientist, who's one of the first people to see and discover the ozone layer. And his theory that, having seen this, it was this incredible sort of mind-blowing experience for him. And the theory that he came up with afterwards was this idea that the Earth isn't just a rocket. So previously the idea was that the Earth happened to be in a Goldilocks zone, right in the sort of just the right distance from the sun in order to have all the right chemicals in order for life to exist. His theory was, no, maybe life created the correct conditions for existence itself. And he writes this book, which is science, but it's called Gaia Theory. And he talks about how life might be self-perpetuating on Earth, and how life is essentially it's one system. You think of yourself as an individual, but actually the planet is just an organism. And, you know, then he goes on to talk about how potentially, you know, the six greatest extinctions on Earth have been from asteroids. Potentially the reason for the human race is because we have just the right sort of mix of aggression and empathy in order to create rockets that could prevent us from being wiped out by the seventh great asteroid invasion. You know, we could save the Earth, sure, but we could destroy it.
But why does science have to be at odds with any of these things that you're calling spirit? It's like all that science is like, if we can't measure it, it can't be true. And that's just madness. It's like, clearly there's been millions of things over the eons that we have then suddenly had the ability to measure, and then we've taken them on board, and now it's science, so we can all relax. And all I'm saying is that this thing that we're now calling spirit doesn't have to be anything more than just very subtle fields that right now we haven't had the ability to measure. And maybe we can only measure them using our bodies as barometers when we're able to be very, very still inside, and then we're able to connect with whatever neutrinos passing through us, or whatever it is. I don't know, but what I do know is that it feels to me very arrogant to suggest that just because we haven't measured it, that these people who are clearly more still than us, who are clearly more able to be with themselves, less caught up in their mental chatter, are talking about stuff all very similarly about how they're feeling things. And for us to just go, well, that's nonsense because I don't want to go there inside my own body and have my own experiences of that, well, that says to me one thing very clearly.
Yeah. And it's intellectual imperialism is what I've heard it described as recently, which I think is a very, very good way to look at it, which was the same thing where, oh, they're savages. We must civilize them. We must bring them way to our way of thinking. You know, I've got a lot of time for that book you're talking about Gaia Theory, but actually that's just appropriation of a much, much older idea that ancient civilizations were carrying around, which was that we're part of one system, we are one people, we are one tribe, you know, like it's actually as old as kind of, you know, the first real societies, as you said, before the agricultural revolution. But I think what Bruce is saying is really important, because when we didn't understand why fire worked, it's also a trap we've got in our language, because it's either, as we were saying, it's spiritual, quote unquote. It's not a great word to use, puts a lot of people off. Even saying it makes me go, you know, especially at this time of, you know, the Islamic State and radical Christianity saying all sorts of madness, or it's magic. Now, that sort of reminds me of dragons and hobbits, and that sits a bit uncomfortably as well. I mean, you've gone to so many places. What are they trying to say that they have words that we can't really get our head around?
Can I sort of do a little adjunct to that? Because there's a moment in his film where Bruce is in the jungle with this guy who's hunting, and he's so much in the moment. And Bruce is talking about how he's kind of constantly thinking about the past and the future and what he's doing later and what he might have done last week. And he can't be in the moment. And I think what you're talking about this antenna connecting us, is in your film you suggest that it's, you almost don't need to try. It's almost there all along, but we've forgotten that we have this deep antenna connection to everything around us. And it's just about getting rid of everything else from your mind and reconnecting with that, isn't it?
Essentially, that, you know, that is anyone who's sort of done mindfulness or meditation, that's kind of the path that it takes you along. And one of the things we sort of suggest or hypothesize in the film a little bit is, like, are things like meditation, are things like the ritual, song, dance, poetry, whatever, are these tools that have been created by civilizations over the years to allow us to reconnect to that place that we were always at once before? And the other thing, I guess, that we sort of pose is the landscape that the film is placed in. We start out with this group, the Penan, who were sort of pre-agricultural society, and I'm posing all this stuff about them being egalitarian and the rest of it, but what is it that shifted during that moment? And then the question I ask is, like, wow, you know, when I go out hunting with this guy, he has to be in that moment concentrating in order to get his
food. For survival.
That he has to do that. Now, not everyone does it, and you don't do it every day, but basically, as part of that society and part of our ancestral heritage, we all needed to be using that bit of the brain to be very, very, very still and very, very, very present and very concentrated in order to survive. But as soon as we start manipulating the landscape, and you can just go planting, you don't need to. It doesn't mean to say there aren't people who can still be very present.
You're thinking more in terms of the future and
in terms of how the whole of our humankind in the last 10,000 years, we as a species have moved away from having to be present on a daily basis. Now, it doesn't mean that people aren't present, but we don't have to anymore. And so perhaps that's the question that we pose in the film. It's like, is this something that, since that moment, we don't need to be meditating anymore? Previously, hunting is a form of meditation.
So true.
And so, but we don't need to hunt. We don't need to meditate anymore. So we have now entered in a space where perhaps another part of our brain, which is much more about the future and the past, another part that's much more about separation, much more about this other way of perceiving the world, has become a louder part, a louder way of perceiving. So as we've shifted away from having to meditate every day, which was the hunt, we are now in a place where we've actually got another part of our brain is more active, it's more loud, and that's running the show, and that's the one that causes us to be separate or feel separate. And that's what we have to undo, and the way to undo that is through these tribal practices.
A lot of the really interesting research that I've seen suggests that what the other thing that comes with the meditation is, it's a bit like if you sit down and tidy a cluttered room. You know, it feels good when you sit in a room that's kind of not cluttered. And when you stop and you close your eyes, and that's, let me be super clear to any skeptic here. Meditation is closing your eyes and listening to yourself breathe. There are different forms of it, but that's it. Anyone can do it. That's how simple it is. And the results are unbelievable. And the first point that's really key here is that when you unclutter the cluttered room, what a lot of people find with stress and anxiety is that it leads to a type of exhaustion, a type of mental exhaustion. And when you sleep, obviously your mind is still running, you're dreaming. But if you actually basically put your brain into MS-DOS mode, the results can kind of be amazing.
I mean, I tried meditating for years because, like, you know, I'd been to Bhutan and places and had little tests there, and I could see that there was something in it, but I couldn't get across it.
What were you struggling with? What was the barrier?
Because I had a very overactive questioning voice constantly there, and also I guess just sitting still I found incredibly difficult. I used to just blame it on my bad knees from the Marines. I just found it a very, very difficult thing to do, and also there was a bit of me that was a bit smirky and a bit skeptical and a bit like, yeah, whatever. And I don't really, you know, so I was kind of avoidant for a long time. But then a dear friend of mine, when I had a slight meltdown, social meltdown, he was like, Bruce, he'd been trying to get me away for ages. He took me away and he took me on a retreat. And it was only after like 3 or 4 days of, I mean, it was a 10-day retreat. Wow. So it was a real privilege to have that much time to be able to spend. But only a few days in did the penny drop. And it's like, oh, my God. This is the greatest gift that I've ever given myself in my life.
What do you think the biggest benefits have been for you of doing it?
So many, but I think I think putting things in perspective, often when I've got so many like variables and problems and like issues going on in my life, that they can just be like on constant loop in my head. And then to go and do a retreat, for example, where you learn the sort of, you know, the techniques that they teach you, where you sort of let go of those loops and sort of transcend them. And then later on, when you come back, everything has a completely different sense of clarity. So I'm able to just make so much more clear decisions, where my life's at and what's important to me, rather than all that little sort of bullshit that was just getting in the way.
Yeah.
And then suddenly it's like, oh my God, I've got to go spend time with my family, you know, whereas previously that hadn't been there at all.
Yeah.
The really important stuff just appears. It just appears because it's actually there. And it just gets you out of the little loops that I was
It's almost
often
like in. A sort of very well-ordered to-do list you come back with, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like, I think that there's a kind of sudden thing where you go, oh no, that's much more important to do than that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've been kind of putting them on an equal footing, but actually that's a waste of time. And I should have, you know, for me, actually, it was a lot to do with my relationship with my mum, and my grandma and my brother. And I still don't feel I spend enough of that, because I think this is really important to say. There's a really good reason why. It's because phones are awesome. Like, they are amazing. If I'm not careful with myself, I spend all my time either attached to this or attached to my screen. And I was working with someone recently, a writer, and he said to me, I just feel like you're constantly in battle with a screen. And I said, what do you mean? And he's like, well, you're either fighting a load of emails, like it's constantly like flying in on you, tapping away, or you're on your phone like, God, I could do this. And I suddenly had this, like, you know, when someone gives you a perspective, you say, looking back, and I was like, oh yeah, I've just got this constant. And that's, I think, everyone, you know, now you've got Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, the latest fucking thing Donald Trump has said to get freaked out about, you know, your email, you know, and that's, you know, I don't even have children, so I mean, you know, when you've got all that to do as well, mummy,
yeah, yeah.
But it is also, like, it's been proved in study after study that there is obviously a lot of ways that people have treated depression before, and we'll talk maybe in a minute about whether pharmaceutical companies are benefiting financially from it, is things like antidepressants. But just sitting quietly, just with yourself, has such a radical effect, because it's like re-nourishes you, because people are just mentally exhausted.
The other thing I found, I totally agree, and it's beautiful what you say. I mean, it's such a gift. And also, I realised I'm never going to be bored again. I can go and sit in any airport without a book, and I can just sit there and just sit upright and meditate.
It's weird, isn't it?
And like, I will always have that up my sleeve wherever I am to, you know, to just be able to be and know that that's nourishing me and helping me. It's just, wow, what a gift to yourself. And like, you know, as you said, it felt self-indulgent at first, but I now come back. I go and do, if I can go and do a week's retreat, that would be my number one thing that I'd like to
do. I've never
done
it for more than like even, I think the longest I've ever done it for is about 25, 30 minutes.
It's mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing the difference in being able to have that opportunity. Honestly, I can't recommend it enough. It's off the charts. I mean, like, I don't buy into the whole Buddhist philosophies and all the rest of it that often come along with these retreats, but just getting the meditation and being able to spend that time doing, essentially working on yourself in a way. And I know that sounds very self-indulgent, and it is time-wise. Obviously, it's a great gift to yourself, but the things that I come back with that just accelerate, and that my relationships, it is actually much more about other people at the end of the day.
Just to say about the self-centered thing, because I think this is really important. You wouldn't think it was self-centered to brush your teeth.
No.
You wouldn't think it was self-centered to have a shower and wash your body because it was dirty, or to, you know, maybe have a shave to be clean shaven. You would think, I don't really want to inflict this on other people because maybe I smell because I haven't showered. The best teacher I had said to me, look, you are inflicting yourself on other people. When you sit with yourself, you're cleaning the you know, it's like you're polishing the inside. You're just sort of like taking a bit of time to repair that bridge. There was a bit of damage there that was done. And then you come out into the world and you're just an easier person to be around.
Well, I mean, that was absolutely it for me. What I realised, especially in the longer retreats, is the a lot of the sort of the background noise that's going on over a period of time, that you can let that go. And then you realize what's just beneath that, you know, this sort of other mental chatter that's like, sometimes stuff comes up and you're like, where did that come from? And this is like something from 16 years ago, and that's clearly there just affecting my behavior. And if you can learn to let it go, I mean, you just basically go through the process of allowing stuff out, and that all of this mental subconscious stuff, and you realize that a lot of the reason why you aren't able to be still and present is because this subconscious stuff is just beneath the surface. And it's almost like, if you imagine, I think of it like as a pool, and I've been operating in the top 5% of this pond, and that's been my sort of conscious awareness, and the rest of it is all my subconscious stuff just churning away. And then you're able to just expand that space, and you go deeper into this other area, and the more you release, the wider that space can be. And then you're able to just be able to be a little bit like some of these tribal people who can just sit there and be chilled and not have to run around and like have to constantly need the addiction to stimulation that we always have, rather than being able to be with ourselves. And that's what it's been. It's like, I can now sit still, whereas previously I couldn't sit still. And that's a huge thing.
Because, I mean, you sort of, obviously you're very interested in these ideas intellectually, but like hearing all of this, what do you think people's blocks are generally? Like, is it just like, oh, spirituality, I was a bit hippy-dippy and stuff? Or,
I mean, I don't understand. What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, because I think that it's kind of interesting. You're like, oh, it makes me feel uncomfortable. That's how you started talking about it. Like, why is that?
I just think I'm probably like Bruce was before he started all this. I find it impossible to sit still. I constantly need stimulation. Constantly... You talk about it in your film about slightly sardonic, witty attitude to everything. I guess so. You don't have to kind of deal with these deep questions. It's not that I'm averse to doing it. I just don't feel like I'm ready to get there at this point. I'm quite enjoying being sardonic and cynical.
No, and
give me another 2 years. I don't know. I'd like to. I just don't know.
So often these things only come about when it's like when you're sort of knocked off the rails somehow. Yeah. You know, I think that was the case for me. I see it as an absolute privilege. I mean, there was no way I was going near any of this shit ever. I mean, like, it was just not on my path. It's only, I mean, I have to thank the BBC for it. I have to thank certain meltdowns that I've had over the years.
That's why we pay our licence fee.
So all three of us have basically had meltdowns as a result of the licence fee payer. So thank you so much.
The licence fee payer has cured you of your inner
tone. You know, but it's like, I often the people who are... who I do know who do meditation stuff with me, we all say the same thing. It's like something happened in our lives that knocked us off, that made us have to reevaluate, and then we kind of started on this path. For most people that just doesn't happen, so I see it as a privilege. But
someone said to me the other day, they were like, because you know you're talking about your these unbelievable experiences, and people come back, oh, you're the guy who took those drugs with you. And we've been doing all this mad stuff, going through the Secret Service. People are like, oh, you gave that book to that whatever that Prime Minister was. And I was having this thing, and a mate of mine said to me the other day, he's like, the truth is, mate, that most people are half watching you through one eye whilst they're chopping up onions and putting the washing up. And that's what it is. And it's like, you know, it is a very bizarre privilege. But Bruce Parry, my goodness.
Bruce, thank you so much for
We've had a good time.
Talk to us about the film. So it is coming up. Tell us the name of it, when we can expect it out.
The film's called Tawai. We're thinking of changing the title to Tawai, A Voice from the Forest. Because Tawai...
How do you spell Tawai?
T-A-W-A-I.
And is there a trailer online people can check out?
Not yet, but Tawai.earth, we're just...
Well, we'll tweet that out when we're...
Having seen it yesterday, I can definitely recommend it. And, you know, you should go and see it in the cinema, as you were saying.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we're looking at we haven't got a date yet, but around the equinox, autumn equinox, the 22nd of September, we're hoping around then.
Incredible. Well, I just feel so privileged to have had this time with you.
Thanks, guys. It's been amazing. We've been around the houses.
Yeah. Well, guys, listen, please subscribe to the podcast, share the podcast, review the podcast. I can excitingly announce that News Roast Live is certainly going to be happening in London in the next couple of months. Maybe if we're lucky and Bruce hasn't, you know, gone off to stick some more bones through his nose, you know, we'll try and actually get him to come down. But it's going to be a panel of some of our guests that have already happened. We are really enjoying the feedback. Thank you for all the feedback on the female guests. We're looking at some of those. We're trying to make this, you know, as balanced as we can. Unfortunately, as to white men, we unfortunately know quite a lot of white men, I'm afraid, but we're trying. The inner feministiness is trying. But listen, thanks so much, Bruce. Thank you so much for being
really good. It's been really good.
And we'll see you next week on the podcast.
Thanks, bye.